welcome to NC Spin, an unrehearsed discussion about issues of interest to North Carolina. Now here's the host of NC Spin, Tom Campbell.
Welcome to NC Spin's premiere on UNC-TV. All of us at NC Spin are delighted to have improved air times and increased coverage as we present balanced debate for the Old North State. There was so much news this week, it's hard to know where to begin, but we'll start with a discussion of the Supreme Court stay on redrawing congressional maps and ask when we might have primary elections in our state. We'll ask how we're going to shrink class sizes with no additional funding and ponder what we aren't being told about Gen X. If there's time, we might get into Raleigh's being a top 20 finalist for the Amazon's second headquarters site and where things stand on judicial reform. But you can count on the fact that we're going to ask our panel to tell us something we don't know.
From treating the newest member of your family to helping a loved one make end-of-life decisions, your family physician is with you every step, for every stage of life, for every member of your family. Despite a healthcare landscape fraught with potential landmines, family physicians across North Carolina are providing you a lifetime of committed, dependable medical care. Family physicians, your trusted healthcare advisor for life.
Agriculture. It's North Carolina's number one economic driver. It puts people to work. It powers our economy. And as agriculture grows, so does our quality of life. North Carolina Farm Bureau is proud to support agriculture and our farmers because agriculture connects us all.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com.
We now return to NC Spin.
Joining our panel this week are syndicated columnist and author John Hood, former state senator and former chairman of the State Board of Education Howard Lee, Josephus Mavretic, a former House Speaker in North Carolina, and political analyst Chris Fitzsimon. Let's get started. When will the primary elections be held? Well, redistricting was 2017's top story and might be a repeat performer. After a three-judge federal panel ruled that North Carolina's congressional maps were unconstitutional, they ordered our legislature to redraw them by next Wednesday. But the legislature appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court for a stay of that decision, and late Thursday of this week, the court granted their request. Joe Mavretic, let's see if we can put all of this in perspective. The Supreme Court did not issue a final ruling as to whether the districts were constitutionally drawn. All they did was say the legislature doesn't have to redraw them right now. So what does this mean so far as our primary elections are concerned this year? The filing period is supposed to open February 12th. Can we expect it to proceed as scheduled?
I'm not sure, and because we have two other cases that are still balls that are up in the air, and I don't know the effect that they might have on the primaries. But there are kind of three cohorts that are critically involved in this. The first is incumbents. If I was an incumbent, I think this is marvelous because all the confusion about delaying the registration helps me raise money and works against the second cohort, which are people who are challenging the incumbents or people who are running for an open space. And they don't know how to program their campaign literature. They don't know how to go about organizing. And the last cohort, that's the people who vote. And for the people who vote, I hope that this is delayed because North Carolina could very easily become a model in America for a 6 to 8 week time frame from primary elections to general election, and think about all the paper we would save that goes into the trash can.
No question about it. But Chris, the Supreme Court said that those who were trying to advocate for the redrawing of the maps right now had not justified why it needed to be done right now. And they said they were already considering cases in Wisconsin and Maryland on these same subjects.
Well, that's the key point. I think that the Supreme Court has already heard arguments on a case about in Wisconsin, whether or not partisan gerrymandering. Remember, we're talking about whether or not it's constitutional to overwhelmingly favor one political party. And David Lewis, the House Rules Chair and redistricting chair, famously said, the reason we have 10 Republican seats out of a 13-seat majority is because the Republicans couldn't figure out how to draw 11 Republican seats in a state that's roughly evenly divided. Now, those comments have come back to haunt him a little bit, but this would be a groundbreaking, earth-shaking, really, political decision if the Supreme Court, and I think it'll be a 5-4 vote one way or the other, says that partisan gerrymandering violates the Constitution. That's something we haven't ever heard of. That would mean a disruption, I think a good disruption, and all states would have to reconsider that.
John, the people who've been advocating for these new maps say, look, we've been disenfranchised essentially since 2012. Since the legislature first drew these congressional districts, we had 2012, 2014, 2016. Now we're getting ready to go through another election cycle being disenfranchised because we've got illegal districts, illegal candidates sitting in these offices. How do you respond to that?
That is the argument they're making. They are parties to a lawsuit. There are other arguments made on the other side, and a three-judge panel has sided with the plaintiffs, but the U.S. Supreme Court has not. And this is different from other kinds of cases, as Chris was getting at. There have been racial gerrymandering cases for decades, other kinds of gerrymandering cases for decades. There isn't any Supreme Court precedent prohibiting partisan gerrymandering. That's the reason why Representative Lewis and other Republicans thought it was okay to use partisanship as a safe harbor. They were basing it on past decisions. So it would be completely irresponsible to order a new set of maps and having election under a standard that is in dispute in front of the U.S. Supreme
Court. Well, John Roberts, speaking for the Supreme Court, seemed to agree with that position?
He clearly did. And remember, this was a 7 out of 9 decision to stay. There were two justices that didn't want to stay the decision, but 7 did. This is much larger than any potential partisan gerrymandering decision majority. So this was a pretty obvious outcome, I think.
Howard, this is not a standalone issue. In the Covington case, which deals with the legislative redistricting, a three-judge panel has already ruled. Well, I take that back. They haven't already ruled that those districts are unconstitutional, but they've ordered the legislature to draw new maps, and secondly, they're in a situation in which they've had a special master appointed. We don't know what's going on with that, but we were told right after the first of the year we should get a verdict on that, a final verdict on that soon. Any idea when that might come?
You know, I don't know, but I sure hope it comes within a reasonable length of time. You know, we have gone through this process of being challenged and engaging in gerrymandering for a number of years, and of course I've been a part of that. But I think we need to clear this up and do it fairly quickly because it's confusing. I can see
us
having...
Well, we've already spent more than $7 million on these lawsuits the state has.
That's right, and I can see people being able to file for Congress and not being knowing when they can file for the legislature. I think it's a giant mess.
And Joe, regardless of how this Covington case is resolved, we can count on the fact there's going to be another appeal, right?
Oh, absolutely. We're, you know, litigious. But there's one thing I think that our viewers ought to keep in mind when we talk about voting and right to vote and whatever. In North Carolina, at least 18% of those eligible to vote don't even register. And of those that are registered, 82%, only about 65-67% ever vote in a general election. Therefore, people are elected in North Carolina with about 55% of the eligible vote in the state. So about 45% of the people in North Carolina who are eligible to vote don't vote.
Don't darken the doors. Chris, this is not the Covington case is not the only issue here. We've got the fact that the legislature passed in special session a bill that eliminated judicial primary elections. That's been taken to court. Could that have some impact on primaries?
Well, I think it'll be, I don't think so. I mean, I think that's an issue whether or not we're going to have judicial primaries at all, which the court is going to have to decide. I think that was a terrible decision. It means we could have people elected to a statewide court if there's 10 or 15 or 20 candidates with a tiny percentage of the vote, which I don't think would serve anybody's interest. I sort of think that's more wrapped up in the whole judicial reform issue than it is in this redistricting snafu.
John, let's play what if for a second.
I love that game.
Okay. What if, ever how it happens, the primary elections are delayed? Joe alluded to that in his opening comments here. Now, there's nothing magic about May primaries. I think we could all agree with that. But you remember back after the 2000 census, we ended up in a situation in which Judge Knox Jenkins actually redrew maps, mm-hmm. and we had summer primaries. What was the response to that? How did that work?
Well, we have had occasionally over the years either primaries in the summer, and I believe at least one time we had a primary in September. And the main thing we know about summer primaries is that the turnout is going to be much lower than in May. And we know that the September primaries may not have a low turnout, but it, as Joe was alluding to earlier, it scrunches up the calendar so that you have not very much time between the end of the primary and the general election. The home stretch for any campaign is the last couple of months in the fall. That's when most of the activity happens. Of course, we have broadened our voting days more so that there's early voting for a couple of weeks
beforehand.
But if
you have a September primary, doesn't that pretty much preclude you being able to put together a good campaign?
Well, the point I'm making is that most of the campaign that reaches people who haven't already made up their minds
Right. Truly
still does happen in September, October.
Well, one thing I think we can all guarantee here, and that is we're going to be talking about this topic some more between now and the date of the primary. So let's move into another topic here. When the legislature returned to Raleigh on January 10th to continue the 2017 session, they've never really finally adjourned, it was expected that they would address how local schools can comply with the reduced class sizes in grades K through 3 without any additional money for teachers or classes. But lawmakers once again returned home without addressing this issue. Howard Lee, the new class size restrictions are not due to go into effect until next school year, the next fall. But lawmakers so far have refused to discuss additional funding. Is it their contention schools already have enough money to do this, or is there some suggestion this might be addressed soon?
Well, that certainly has been one position. I've listened to Senator Berger yesterday when he was saying that he felt enough money had been appropriated to carry out this process. Personally, and looking at it, I question that. I've been told, at least listening to Senator John Alexander,
Johnny Mac,
March, they intend to try to address and resolve this, and he says they've heard what the people said. But, you know, class size to me is being given a lot more weight than I think it has value when it comes to the school systems, number one. Number two, I hate to see them take away the flexibility of school leaders being able to use these funds to accommodate their own needs. And number three, the legislature will have to be patient, even if they fully appropriate these class sizes and appropriate enough money. They're still going to have time to adjust to this.
You put your finger on the problem, the first problem, I think, very succinctly, Senator. John, is there proof that reduced class sizes, particularly in the early grades, helps improve student outcomes?
There is some evidence to that effect for very young students. I agree with Howard, though. It's not overwhelming. The effect is not very large. Now, the truth is that the studies that we have so far on all educational reforms are that the effect sizes are not dramatic. But the class size reduction is a very expensive way to get a moderate to modest effect. So I actually agree that the priority should have been and continue to be on higher quality teachers. If you have an excellent teacher and you expose that teacher to 23 students, that's better than a mediocre teacher who has 19 students.
But Joe, you were nodding your head saying there is evidence, and you are the father of a principal, so.
Yeah, but he's a high school principal. Yeah, I think class size does make a difference. Whether it's statistically a big number or not doesn't make much difference. I think this is what I call in politics a game of blink.
Ah.
And I think that's what's going on. And I think the General Assembly leadership is saying, okay, you will do this. Now let's see who blinks first.
Well, and the other side of that is that the people in the local school systems, Chris, are saying, hey, you do this without any additional funding, we're going to have to cut art, we're going to have to cut PE, we're going to have to cut music programs.
Well, there's a couple
is that a bluff?
Well, one is whether or not class size, I think it's good that in the early grades to have smaller classes. Whether it's good or not, the law now is the schools have to do it. Then the question is, do they have enough money? And I think you're starting to see more and more Republicans come around. I think the state house, obviously also overwhelmingly Republican, has been ready several times to provide the money or to give relief to class size. You mentioned Senator Alexander, a Republican from Raleigh. He seems to think we need to give the schools either more money or some relief. The Senate leadership hasn't done it yet. Another thing I think is really worth pointing out, he's talking about a special session in March. It's worth remembering every time we need to, the General Assembly does not work like it used to. We have 1 and 2 and 3 day sessions. Nobody knows what's on the agenda. They adjourn, they come back. Now we're here and they're going to come back in March and address it.
$55,000 a day.
Well, and it's impossible for citizens and even legislators themselves to keep up. This is a ridiculous way to run a government.
All right, very quickly, around the horn, yes or no kind of answer. Do you think we're going to see additional funding? Joe?
Yes.
John?
Eventually, yes.
Yes.
I think the House will pass it and the Senate won't do it until the short session, if at all.
All right. Well, obviously, that's another topic that we are going to be following as we proceed through this coming year. Let's move to another one. Gen X is the big issue. Gen X is a byproduct contaminant from the production of Teflon. And a plant on the Cumberland-Bladen County border has until just recently been releasing this chemical in the Cape Fear River. Measurable levels of Gen X have been found in Wilmington and other locales. And the former mayor of Wilmington is urging people not to drink the water there. Newspapers along the Cape Fear have written countless stories and editorials raising questions about the safety of the water, but don't feel like state officials are properly responding to their concerns. Chris, what aren't we being told about this issue? Doesn't it seem a little mysterious that our state hasn't been willing to put on a full court press to find out how big a problem this is?
There's a lot of things going on. I don't think we know how big a problem it is. I think the Cooper administration and DEQ believes this is a statewide issue, not just confined to the state Cape Fear River or area, and there's some evidence of that. Shockingly, in a special session just recently concluded, the State House overwhelmingly, unanimously, all Republicans and Democrats, I think it was 119-0, voted to appropriate $2.3 million to address this. The bulk of that money was already appropriated to DEQ for a cockamamie scheme to help Jordan Lake, which now everybody admits doesn't work, even the House leadership doesn't work. So that's not new money, the bulk of it. Was to do more monitoring, to buy some more equipment, to do things. The Senate refused to even take it up, which I think is a scandal.
Well, what's up with that? Senator Phil Berger, the president pro tem of the Senate, the House passed this legislation. It went over, supposedly, to the Senate. Before the Senate even had an opportunity to read it, they adjourned. And Senate President Pro Tem Phil Berger, in his response to all of that, seemed to indicate, hey, we've already done enough on Gen X.
Well, I think the argument that the Senate Republicans make is this is an example of the need to set priorities. If this is a high priority to work on, a high priority for DEQ to work on, then there's already appropriated funds, there's staff positions to work on the highest priority. If this is it, make it number one or number two or whatever and get it done. In other words, you're not lacking money to do your highest priority, you're lacking money to do a lower priority. That's the argument.
Joe, you came from the northeastern part of the state and the rural part of the state. Are the people in the southeastern North Carolina justified in feeling like they ain't getting very much help and love here from our state leaders?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at North Carolina's compartmentalization, on the coastal plain, you have the Northeast, and you have that corridor that goes down Highway 70, and then you've got the Cape Fear area. And the Cape Fear area always has kind of felt that they are a semicircle all into their own. But going back to the issue, the basics are that we don't really address water issues in North Carolina for the priority that they should have. You know, after clean air, it's clean water or you die. And we need a position in North Carolina, a policy that says the water that comes out's got to be at least as clean as the water that went in.
Howard, all of us remember the fact that for years and years and years down at Camp Lejeune, people down there complained about the water. They said it was making them sick. Officials seemed to ignore what was going on. Finally, the evidence became so overwhelming that they couldn't deny the fact that the water was creating problems and causing illnesses. why go through that again? Why not just to tackle this problem with Gen X and let's find out how big a problem it is?
Well, that's the thing that's baffling me. I have been watching this process, and I think there's no question there's a need to give some concentrated attention to trying to resolve this problem, even if people psychologically feel that their health is being impacted. But we seem to have a history of this. We watched Texas Gulf sulfur pollute rivers. We watched others do that. And so I think we need to get on with it.
I think it's important to remember, though, the State House voted to do something about it.
Yes.
All the Republicans in the State House and the Speaker of the House said, we have a great bill here. A lot of it is not new money. It's not about priorities. We've cut the Department of Environmental Quality significantly over the last few years. And remember, this is money we're reallocating from a scheme that didn't work to try to help people in southeastern North Carolina. And the Senate, shockingly, didn't even have a debate about it.
Well, forgive me for being a cynic here, but I'm looking at this from the standpoint of what is it we don't understand about all of this? Well, it looks like we've got a Democratic governor, we've got a Democratic mayor of Fayetteville, a Democratic mayor of Wilmington, the two biggest cities along the Cape Fear River. Is this becoming political gamesmanship?
No. Keep in mind that most of this area is represented by Republicans in the General Assembly. So I don't. There may be other arguments to make, but not a straight partisan argument, no.
All right. For more on this topic, I'd like to invite you to come visit our website, ncspin.com, and read my column this week. On this same subject. While we're talking about items of interest to North Carolina, I think it's got to be noted that late this week we found out that Amazon has announced that Raleigh has become one of the top 20 finalists for their second headquarters site. Some 50,000 jobs are at stake. $5 billion worth of investments are going to be made here. Joe, this could be a pretty big fish.
Well, it could be, but typically the opening arguments overstate how many jobs and how much money by about 50%. So I suspect that we're talking a whole lot less than 50,000 jobs.
Howard, we lost the Toyota Mazda plant, we found out a week or so ago. We're 0 for 25, by the way, as far as automobile manufacturing is concerned. But the point was, I understand we offered $1.5 billion in economic incentives. Alabama only offered $350 million. How did we end up losing that?
Well, I think that there are a number of problems with North Carolina. Certainly, I'm sure they were looking at our employee training and development. And I think we should stop chasing all these big fish and start looking at how we can grow some small minnows into big fish.
Let me jump in here. He's absolutely right. On a previous show, we talked about how much it was, how big it was, and I was all favor of it. But now I want to know how much it's going to cost, because I think there's another way to look at it.
Well, there's some other things that I want to know, and that is I want you guys to tell me something I don't know. Chris Fitzsimon, let's start with you.
Well, there was a special election in the Wisconsin General Assembly a couple weeks ago. It was a district that Republicans had won by more than 20 percentage points last time. A Democrat won it. And I think this is evidence we've talked about on this NC Spin before the last few months. As President Obama was president, the Republicans gained 1,000 legislative seats. I think there's another wave coming in the legislature. The question is, will it come to North Carolina?
All right. Tell me something I don't know, Joe Mavretti.
Religion, race, reciprocity, subsistence and justice. I think our viewers ought to keep these concepts in mind for at least 2018.
Say those again.
Election says religion, race, reciprocity, subsistence and justice. Because I think when you listen to the rhetoric of the 2018 campaigns, if you weigh the rhetoric by these three words, a lot's going to come to the surface.
I didn't write them down. I got to go back and see that again. Religion and race and reciprocity.
Subsistence and justice.
Okay, these are the issues for 2018. Howard Lee, tell us something we don't know.
You know, we talked earlier about class size, and of course there's a movement taking shape around the country to reduce school district sizes. And of course we've had a little taste of that here in North Carolina, and I think it's a good direction in which to go. I think our school districts are just too impersonal, too large, and almost to the point of being unmanageable.
You know, on a previous show, you've actually advocated that we should cut down the size of our schools, the number of students.
Absolutely.
In our schools.
Absolutely. I'm still very strongly for that.
And you're in favor of reduced school districts,
too. I'm in favor of reducing school districts. I think a Wake County district is just too big and too impersonal and almost too unmanageable. And I'll go more details about that.
But the economies of scale don't make that much difference.
I think you have a better chance of educating kids and having more concentrated attention. No.
John Hood, tell us something we don't know.
Well, number one, Howard Lee is absolutely right about school districts, and the evidence suggests it. Number two, just like every year for the last several years, people panicked when they got the initial budget numbers for the current fiscal year in North Carolina and predicted gigantic deficits. According to the most recent information, that gap in revenue estimates versus collections has gone down from $134 million to about $43 million. It'll probably keep going down. Now, we should watch budget numbers carefully, but people should stop panicking at the beginning of a fiscal year. It's foolish.
Well, you've heard our spin on the issues of the day. To stay informed all during the week, give your feedback and read my weekly column. Be sure to visit our website, ncspin.com. Or catch NC Spin on Facebook and join us next week when we'll have more balanced debate for the Old North State. Until then, stay informed and watch out for the spin.
Join us next week and get the spin on issues facing our state. For more information or to learn how to contact us, visit our website, ncspin.com. NC Spin is a copyrighted production of Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated.
From treating the newest member of your family to helping a loved one make end-of-life decisions, your family physician is with you every step, for every stage of life, for every member of your family. Despite a healthcare landscape fraught with potential landmines, family physicians across North Carolina are providing you a lifetime of committed, dependable medical care. Family physicians, your trusted healthcare advisor for life.
Agriculture. It's North Carolina's number one economic driver. It puts people to work. It powers our economy. And as agriculture grows, so does our quality of life. North Carolina Farm Bureau is proud to support agriculture and our farmers because agriculture connects us all.